This is week three of the Dharma seminar series that I'm calling A Field Guide to the Bodhisattvas. Most of you have been here already for at least one, but some of you haven't. To say, Bodhisattvas are Buddhist characters, images, expressions of particular qualities. In Jungian language, archetypes. And we've talked about, and when you look at images of them, often they look kind of similar, and their Sanskrit names sound kind of long and incomprehensible. And so the idea of this series is to kind of give you some identifying features so you can recognize them, not only when you see an image, but in the world around us, in daily life, as they are embodied in each of us and in others around us. Bodhisattvas being beings, sattva is a being, and bodhi is awakening. So awakening beings who vow to serve other beings, serve the awakening of other beings. Basically, as we chant in our bodhisattva vows, beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Or we vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. We vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. We vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. We vow to embody it. Is one way. Those are the four bodhisattva vows. So, the first week we talked about Manjushri, the bodhisattva of wisdom. Last week we talked about Samantabhadra, the bodhisattva of shining practice, of activity. And today it's Avalokiteshvara, bodhisattva. I hope you're starting to have some bodhisattva sightings, you know, out in the world. You know, oh, well, that might be, you know, Samantabhadra. Avalokiteshvara, bodhisattva of compassion, is probably really one of the most beloved and popular bodhisattvas of all in the Mahayana Buddhist world. And even in Theravada Buddhist countries like Sri Lanka or Myanmar, he or she is where in the Theravada tradition, bodhisattvas aren't emphasized, but Avalokiteshvara is kind of a folk bodhisattva in some Theravadan countries, going back to earlier times. So Avalokiteshvara. Oh, I didn't do the Sanskrit etymology. So I'll have to save that. But in Chinese, and I think it is quite similar, it's, and I'll give it to you in Japanese, but the characters are the same. Kanzeon Bosatsu, that's bodhisattva. So kan, in English this becomes hearing the cries of the world. Kan means regarding, observing, perceiving, hearing. Ze is the world, on is sounds. So translation, hearing the sounds of the world. And that's actually is apparently, I'm no Sanskrit scholar, very close to what the Sanskrit means. Or Kanji Zai, and that's what we chant in the Heart Sutra, Kanji Zai Bosatsu Gyojin, right? Kanji Zai Bosatsu. Kan, again, same, hearing, perceiving, seeing. And Ji Zai is self-existence. So what that comes to mean is perceiving self-existence is without obstruction, without hindrance, is the implication there. Freely, freely. So when we chant the Heart Sutra, Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, when practicing deeply, that's how they end up translating it, the Prajnaparamita, that first line, Kanji Zaibo Satsugyojin Hanyaharamita. So what's significant is it's the Bodhisattva of compassion who, seeing deeply into the nature of existence, perceives the emptiness of all phenomena. So the Heart Sutra is about the emptiness of all phenomena, and it's the Bodhisattva of compassion who's giving this teaching. Right? And by emptiness, of course, we mean impermanent and without a fixed self nature. So every phenomenon existing only in interconnection, in boundless interconnection with all other phenomena through space and time, right? Space and time. That's what we mean by emptiness in this context, or boundlessness is perhaps the better word. And it's from this realization that wisdom and compassion are born. So this figure of Avalokiteshvara is speculated to have been absorbed into Mahayana Buddhism from the Hindu deity Vishnu or Shiva. And you can kind of see this in the early representations. So here's Avalokiteshvara in the Ajanta caves of India. And holding a lotus. And here's a Sri Lankan image of Avalokiteshvara. You know, it looks very like the images of Hindu gods, right? And then there's a Cambodian one looking very Cambodian. Mm-hmm. But then as, so very male. But then as Avalokiteshvara moved into China in the 5th century, initially looking still quite male, or more androgynous, actually. This is the pose, this is the an interesting position for a Buddhist image. It's called the pose of royal ease, sitting with one knee up. So somewhat more androgynous, and then much more female as time went on in China. So that by the time Kuan Yin now becomes Kannon in Japan, very, very female. Predominantly female images in Japan. Not exclusively, but mostly. And then into Tibet, oh, this, by the way, is an image of a Jibo Kannon, which is means loving mother. Loving Mother Kannon, who is 57 meters high. You can see the trees down below. It's a giant Kannon. And then in Tibetan Buddhism, Avalokiteshvara becomes Chenrezig. And in female manifestation, Tara. So here's Chenrezig in the middle, with a green Tara and a yellow Tara on either side. I think there are also blue and red and white Taras. And there are practices that go with each of those, which is far more than we can even touch on here. But it's very important in Tibetan Buddhism as well. So I'm going to refer from now on to Kannon, because I'm going to talk a little bit more about the Japanese tradition, which is our tradition. And like Samantabhadra, who we talked about last week, she assumes many forms and guises using many implements to skillfully and compassionately respond to the needs of suffering beings. But unlike Samantabhadra, Her many forms have been richly depicted in art and folklore and literature, whereas Samantabhadra, that's not pictured. So probably one of the earliest images in Chinese Buddhism is the white-robed Kuan Yin. The Bodhisattva wears a white robe covering head and body and holds often a mala, not in this image, a mala in one hand and in the other a sutra, which would be the Lotus Sutra, and sometimes she holds a vessel pouring the nourishing water of the Dharma out for suffering beings. One version of the white robe Kanon is the willow branch Kuan Yin. These two are Chinese that I just showed you. That's a kind of not a very vigorous looking willow branch. It's in the little vessel she's holding. The bamboo looks a little more vigorous. But the willow has many layered associations. It symbolizes, kind of like the bamboo, that flexible strength the Dharma gives us to respond to adversity without being broken by it. The willow is an ancient symbol, Chinese symbol of femininity and compassion. It was also used in shamanistic practices for contacting the spirit realms. Often branches are used in shamanistic traditions. And white willow bark was known for its medicinal properties, its anti-inflammatory properties, by traditional peoples for many, many years. Not until 1828 was its active ingredient salicin identified as the precursor of aspirin. The imagery of these white-robed Kuan Yins and the folklore surrounding, there are many, many, many folk tales in China and Japan about Kuan Yin, and they very much resemble the folk tales about the Virgin Mary in Europe of about the same time they rose in popularity. And we could speculate that maybe in response to the need, a similar need for a kind of benevolent female deity in a patriarchal religion. In Japan, during the shogunate period, 1700s, there was a substantial Christian population, mostly in the south around Nagasaki, and during the shogunate period, the Christians were quite harshly persecuted. And they went underground. And so this is a Virgin Mary Kanon. This is a Virgin Mary, notice, holding the baby Jesus, disguised as a Kanon. And this was found hidden inside a Buddha statue. And often inside the Mary Kanons was a little cross. So this is from underground Christianity. There is speculation that this image, the white-robed image of Kuan Yin, actually was influenced by images of the Virgin Mary coming across the Silk Road much, much earlier. You know, this is 16th, 17th century. So these linkages across time are pretty interesting. Another early form called the sacred canon or show canon is very, very simple, just standing with one hand holding either a lotus or the vessel with the Dharma water in it, and the other hand extended in the mudra of fearlessness. So this is the mudra of fearlessness. In this case, she's I think that's the teaching mudra on the other hand, the right hand. And if you look later on, I put some images on the altar. The tall one is the fearlessness, the mudra, and the, we decided it was a variation. It's quite unusual. It's this one. No, sorry. I can't do it. There it is. That one, third finger. And I looked and looked to try and find that one. It's unusual, but it's a variation of the teaching mudra, apparently. And the other one, the smaller one to the right, she's holding a lotus and with the fearlessness mudra. And that one, Michael carved when we lived in Japan. And he was only about 30. And everyone else in the Buddha carving class were seniors, so he was the class pet. And it was wonderful. You know, he was taught by a master carver. It was a wonderful, really special experience. So take a look at her. And here's another. This is called the Nyoirin Canon, or turning the jewel of the Dharma. See the jewel? Usually portrayed sitting on a lotus blossom, often in that informal pose, see, with the one knee up, sometimes with six arms, and holding that wish-fulfilling jewel, which is the jewel of the Dharma, the triple treasure. Sometimes it's a triple jewel, not this one. You've heard the mantra Om Mani Padme Om Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum, which is the jewel, hail the jewel in the lotus, the jewel in the lotus. Sometimes it's called the wish-fulfilling jewel. But wish-fulfilling jewel doesn't mean it's some kind of Aladdin's lamp that you rub and, you know, ask for what you desire and then it magically appears. Our deepest wish beneath our craving for a new iPhone or for the perfect mate, spouse, or the perfect job, our deepest, or even, you know, even to be enlightened, our deepest wish is to be free from suffering, you know, to express who we are, without hindrance. That's the jewel of the Dharma that Canon offers us, is that freedom. However, often in the folklore, she does provide means of prosperity to deserving but virtuous poor people, so that it's a skillful means to allow them to live a beneficial life in the world. There's a lot of folk tales along those lines. But perhaps the most well-known image is, of course, the thousand-arm canon. Whoops. There. That thousand-arm canon is a contemporary image from China, from a nunnery, a Buddhist nunnery in China, apparently. So the thousand arms depict Canon's ability to use skillful means. Each of the hands has an eye in the palm of the hand to perceive the particular need of that each suffering being, and each hand, well, symbolically, not all those hands do, but usually there's an array of about 30 to 40 hands that hold different implements to help. A mirror for drawing forth wisdom, a moon ring for dispelling poison, relieving fever, an arrow for meeting true friends, a vial to bring harmony in relationships, an open hand for relieving fear and anxiety, a bell for a beautiful voice, a duster for removing obstacles, a hook for pulling down harmful dragons. Now, there are, of course, beneficial dragons as well. and a skull for casting out demons. So some of the, there's some of the examples of the tools. There you can see the tools better. There's often a rope for kind of lassoing the, you know, miscreants and people who don't behave. The most, the famous Sanju Sangendo, or Hall of the 33 Bays or Sections, contains 1,000 golden images of the Thousand Armed Kannon. This is in Kyoto, Japan. And you can't tell at a glance, but if you look carefully, you'll see that every single one has distinct individual features. No two are alike. So they are us. It's a very deeply moving display, actually, of our own bodhisattva nature. Each of us making an offering to sentient beings from our own unique repertoire of tools and abilities. These are old. These are quite old, and they're very, very beautiful. Now, you may have noticed that some of these images have more than one head. Oh, this is a quite a modern and very large thousand-arm kannon. You can see the tools. And it's in this big barn-like structure, rather inelegant, in the town where Shunyu Suzuki Roshi's temple is located, where when Michael and I have taken groups to Japan, we stay at the temple. It's called Rinsoin. And one day the priest, Suzuki Roshi's grandson's wife, took us to this temple, and she told us later that it's been kind of the priest spent huge amounts of money having this very large kannon built and the building to house it, and he's been kind of criticized because people come in tour buses to you see them lined up to go and bow to the kannon, and then you can see along the edges that's where the merchandise is, the little amulets and postcards, and so it really is a place of devotional practice more than anything. But apparently the locals were a little critical that this was too ostentatious for this little town. But it shows you a little bit of present-day Japan. So I was just mentioning, you see some of them have multiple heads. These are the, they're called the 11-faced kannons. And usually the way it goes, sometimes they go all the way around like a crown, but usually there's a layer of three heads that are gentle or compassionate, another three that are kind of fierce for tough love, right? And then three fanged faces, which apparently, curiously, are for encouraging those who are already making strong efforts. Not quite sure how that works, but that's... And then one laughing face, which is always facing backward. That's so we don't take ourselves too seriously. And on the very top is Amida Buddha, the Buddha of the Pure Land. So this one has both the 1,000 arms and the 11 heads. And there's the 11 heads again. The story goes that Kannon... making this vow, this tremendously impossible vow, to save all beings. And was taking a group of beings to the Pure Land, and then looked back and saw how many beings were still suffering in the world of samsara, immediately filling in the spaces of the ones that she had saved. And her grief was so great that her head split open. Feels like that sometimes, doesn't it? Feels like your head might split open. And Amida Buddha restored her head 10 times, and each time her head split open again. And then finally he put his own head on top. So that's the story of how that image came to be. So even Kannon Bodhisattva needed a little help to restore her deep confidence and capacity to bring compassion to the suffering beings in the world. So this is an image that can kind of remind us of that. Then in modern-day Japan, some new specialty Kannon figures have emerged. With the aging population, Japan has an even greater proportion of very aged people than our culture does. This dementia-preventing Kannon. See, that's a little old man, a little old woman. They look kind of childlike, but they're... Yeah. And then also, with increasing wealth and urbanization and many more single people, the role of animals and pets has changed. So thus, pet protecting and memorializing Kannon has been... This is a little blurry, but she's holding, you know those little Japanese dogs with curly tails? Mm-hmm. She's holding one of those Japanese dogs. And also, Kannon has long been associated to some extent with protecting women and children and mothers. And that's a role that overlaps with Jizo Bodhisattva, who we're going to look at next week. But post-World War II, with the increasing prevalence of abortion in Japan, that the role of Jizo as a protector of children who die young and also of miscarriages and abortions, this role has been extended to Kannon too. So you'll find in Jizo shrines, which I'm going to show you next week, you'll find right in the middle of the Jizo shrine a Kannon like this, holding a baby. Another modern iteration is the Peace Kannon. This is another, this one's really big. This is on the hillside in Kyoto, you know, another maybe 50 meters. But you will find Peace Kannons incorporated into the peace parks of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, for example. And more controversially, shrines commemorating the war dead, like the kamikaze pilots. And then finally, from our own, this is not the end of the talk, but in terms of modern day Kannons, we have from our beloved Mayumi Oda, Japanese-American artist, the Green Gulch Kannon, protector of the fields and gardens of Green Gulch Farm, which is part of San Francisco Zen Center. You see, she's got her little vessel of water, watering the cabbages. And also from Mayumi, the kitchen Kannon. You need more than two arms in the kitchen. How are we coming? Oh dear. You know what? We need 2 nights for Kannon. There's so much. I'm leaving out the folktale.
No.
No, okay, I take it back. This is just a little. There are hundreds and hundreds. I really want to do a children's book of Bodhisattva tales from Japan, because they're wonderful. A common theme, as I said, is a poor young man or woman who is orphaned and alone in the world without support, visits a local Kannon shrine and calls upon the Bodhisattva for support. in one tale, the young woman who has asked Kanon for help is visited by a wealthy widower who asks her to marry him, of course.
Weird.
Well, you know, this is what happened. She accepts, and she wants to serve him a meal, but has nothing to offer him. And she appeals to Kanon for help. And soon a woman servant from the neighbor's house appears with a chest full of delicious food. The young woman has nothing to give to express her gratitude except the red shawl she's wearing, so she gives the servant the red shawl. The next day she goes to her neighbors to thank them, but they insist they have no idea what she's talking about. So she goes to the Kanon shrine, where she finds the red shawl wrapped around the Kanon. So that's a really typical story. There's lots and lots like that. Another common form is Kanon taking the place of a person who is, and she's a shapeshifter, taking the place of a person who is then injured or killed, and then the Kanon in the little shrine is found with blood on her, and the person is unharmed, so she'll substitute herself for a worthy person. But perhaps the most, so there's lots more. We can, like, I'll save them for another time. But and the most important appearance of Kanon is in the Lotus Sutra. There's a chapter called the Kanon, it's often called the Kanon Sutra in the Lotus Sutra. It's called the Gateway chapter. And in it, Kanon saves beings in many, many different ways. It begins, and this is an English translation of the complete Soto Zen chant book. And in Soto Zen temples and monasteries in Japan, this chapter, or at least a verse section of this chapter, is chanted every day. It begins with a bodhisattva named Akshayamati asking the Buddha, why is Kanon called regarding the cries of the world? The Buddha answers, listen to the deeds of Avalokiteshvara, who aptly responds in every quarter, with vast vow as deep as oceans, through kalpas beyond reckoning. He served many thousands of millions of Buddhas, bringing forth this great pure vow. And then it goes verse after verse of telling how Kanon will save you. So if someone with harmful intent should push you into a fiery pit, by mindfully invoking Avalokiteshvara's power, the pit of fire will turn into a pool. I'm just going to read you four. If imprisoned in shackles and chains, hands and feet bound in restraints, by mindfully invoking Avalokiteshvara's power, suddenly you shall be released. If clouds, thunder, and lightning strike, hailstones fall, and it rains in torrents, by mindfully invoking Avalokiteshvara's power, instantly they will dissipate. In disputes before judges or fearful in the midst of battle, by mindfully invoking Avalokiteshvara's power, all hostilities will be dispersed. So we don't chant this here in the West, because I think it maybe seems a little bit like magical thinking, or, you know, we don't really think that way. But if you just... just those four verses, if you just think a little bit, you know, when someone pushes you into that fiery pit of anger, right, and you're feeling, you know, incredibly resentful, you're feeling really wronged, How does it feel to have compassion for yourself? Or to feel heard and accepted with compassion by someone else? Or even to open your own heart to compassion for the person who hurt you out of their own greed, aversion, or ignorance? Well, that's what's being described in that first verse. And the second verse I read, you know, about being imprisoned in shackles and chains. How many of us have heard or read of individuals of great kind of inner spiritual strength and compassion who've been able to maintain an inner freedom, even through long imprisonment and even torture? You know, Nelson Mandela or the Tibetan monks and nuns who suffered horrible torture in Chinese prisons with an inner calm and an active compassion for those who harmed them. And they survived. They survived. Some of them didn't, but some survived, maybe with broken bodies and damaged health, but amazingly resilient minds and free of PTSD. You know, they've been studied. So that's what the second verse is describing. And when the storms, you know, the storms and floods of emotional turmoil assail us, or life events beyond our control, right? How can simple kindness and compassion help us through? I remember after the earthquake and tsunami in Japan and nuclear disaster in Japan, I read there was a website with a collection of stories of just simple acts of kindness, everyday ordinary acts of kindness that Japanese people did to help each other during those times. That's what the third verse is talking about. And the fourth one that I read, in disputes before judges or fearful in the midst of battle, you know, think of just how adversarial our world is. You know, everything from neighbors suing each other to nations warring against each other. And if there was a way that we could teach compassion in schools and peaceful conflict resolution, the whole relationship to conflict and how we deal with conflict would change. So that's that verse. Tygen Layton, who wrote the book Images, Faces of a Compassion that I used a lot for these talks, tells of meeting a Japanese monk who practiced at Eiheiji, the main monastery in Japan, who was practicing at Green Gulch Farm. And he told it, Tygen asked the monk what he missed most about Eiheiji, and he said it was chanting this Kanon chapter of the Lotus Sutra. That's what he missed most. I just thought, I wonder what it meant to him, those verses of all the different ways that Kanon helps. Oops. Those are some of the many, the 33, there's said to be 33 manifestations of Kanon, that she appears as laymen and laywomen and priests and monks and nuns and children and poor people and beggars, scholars, all the different versions. And this here's a contemporary representation of Kanon riding a dragon. There are these are all taken from that chapter in the Lotus Sutra, the 33 different versions. So there's the dragon. Oh, there's Mayumi Yoda's dragon Kanon. This is the moon The moon canon who meditates on the reflection of the moon on the water. So there's actually, she's on a kind of little island, and there's water down below. And this is the fish basket canon, who appears as a peasant woman selling fish in the marketplace, distributing the food of the Dharma. And often she is depicted with a big carp. And there she is on someone's back. See, the tattoo? Yeah, the carp. That's. And then there is the one leaf canon who saves fishermen in trouble on the sea, riding on a leaf. And this is at Eheiji, the monastery in Japan, because it said that when Dogen was on his way to China, no, he was returning. When he was returning from China, a great storm blew up, and he chanted the Kanon chapter from the Lotus Sutra through the storm, and he had a vision of the one leaf Kanon coming, and that helped him get through the storm. Okay. And there's the last one, another Mayumi Oda Kanon with some tools. So, oh dear, I had a koan to give you about Kanon, and instead of doing it now, I'm going to put it in my Dharma talk on Sunday, so you have to wait. Mm-hmm. So instead of asking you to... It's a little bit much to ask you to answer a koan. No, I'm going to tell you it anyway. It's really simple. Yunyan asked Dao, "What does the Bodhisattva of great compassion use so many hands and eyes for?" Wu said, "It's like someone reaching back, groping for a pillow in the middle of the night." Yen said, "I understand." Wu said, "How do you understand it?" Yen said, "All over the body, hands and eyes." Wu said, "You've said quite a bit there, but you've only said 80% of it." Yen said, "What do you say, elder brother?" Wu said, "Throughout the body are hands and eyes." "What does the Bodhisattva of great compassion use so many hands and eyes for?" "It's like reaching back for a pillow in the middle of the night. All over the body are hands and eyes. Throughout the body are hands and eyes." Okay, there it is. You have 10 minutes to figure that out. Get in groups of three or four. And just, what comes to mind?